It was great to catch up with Abby Hawkins for the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews. Abby was one of my students at the University of Kent a few years ago. She studied philosophy and she is now the head of religious education at one of the grammar schools in Canterbury. She talks about how she always wanted to be a teacher. She talks about how she did, though, once consider going into acting. She belonged to a drama club when she was young and she played an orphan in the musical Annie at Canterbury's Marlowe Theatre. We find out what Abby's earliest memories are. We talk about the degree to which holidays require us to navigate the break in our routinized lives. We find out about her earliest musical memories, about why she has a genuine wish to go back to Australia, and why she would have to manage her expectations if she did so. Abby tells us why, in some respects, she feels she has missed out on the university experience due to not moving away from home. She talks about studying logic and the experience of her first logic seminar. She talks about her filmic influences. We find that she's not a fan of 3D, but she is a fan of A Muppet's Christmas Carol. We talk about how she uses film in the context of teaching. We talk about students and voting, and the challenging occasion when she was once asked in a bar to explain what philosophy is. We find out why Abby has always loved school, especially the pressure that exams give, why she is still in touch with four best friends from school, and in the final part of the interview, we find out whether Abby is a looking back or a looking forward type of person. So join me. My name is Chris DC. My guest this week is Abby Hawkins. Well, it's my pleasure this afternoon to be with Abby Hawkins, who, of course, I taught not too many years ago. I think you were here from, was it 2011? 2012.
Yeah.
And you did
philosophy.
And what are you doing now, Abby?
So now I am the head of department at the Simon Langton Girls' School, the religious studies department, the religious education department, teaching Key Stage 3, 4 and 5 religious studies, so with philosophy elements in there as well.
So does it feel very different to being on the other side of the lecturer's chair, shall we say?
It does, but I think it was something that I always wanted to do. So even through my undergraduate studies, even through university, it was something I wanted to do. I volunteered in schools and stuff. So, yeah, so it is different. And it's nice for me to be able to teach maybe the subjects that I struggled with the most, like the philosophy of language was something I always really struggled with, but now I feel that that's one of the subjects that I teach best because I had to try really hard to get my head around it myself. So now I feel like when I deliver that, that's the one I deliver really well.
Yeah, there is that great thing about teaching. If sometimes you really go to town on something and say, I really have to get to grips with this, then disseminating that in a teaching context is a lot easier because you've already gone through all those steps in your head. Because I find sometimes if I'm lecturing on something on my own research area, just sometimes I feel that it's almost like when you wear lots of different hats and you think, well, I'm used to writing this all down for the purposes of, you know, reviewing a book or writing a book or whatever it might be. But when you're then communicating that to students, you think, well, you know, I have to think that this is going out to a different audience. And it feels very different and I don't actually enjoy it so much.
No, I agree. And I think that, like I say, almost when I completely understand something myself, I almost struggle sometimes to see how somebody else couldn't understand it. And so I think whereas the topics that I've struggled with in the past, I can understand and kind of almost like preempt some of the questions that are going to come up, and that really helps aid the teaching.
Yeah. But tell me a bit about your background in terms of when and where you were born.
Okay, so I was born in Canterbury. So born in Canterbury and brought up in Whitstable. Went to school in Canterbury and then to the two universities in Canterbury as well. So very much a local girl.
So one of them for your PGCE, I'm taking.
So philosophy at University of Kent and PGCE in religious education, 7 to 14 I did, the ages 7 to 14, at the Christchurch.
And in terms of what your parents do, is there teaching in the family? Is anyone in your family?
So my mum is a teaching assistant. She always has worked in schools ever since my brother and I were younger. She took a small kind of part-time job in a school to be at home for me and my brother while we were growing up, and then she's taken on more full-time roles since then. So she works at a school in Canterbury as well.
Yeah, so do you find that you're comparing notes a lot of the time in terms of like, which are the best? Obviously, don't answer this question, but you must presumably sort of compare experiences. She's obviously had more experience than you, but you're, you know, sort of completely full on in what you're doing as the head of a department.
Yeah, I think definitely I would draw on her experience, especially because her specialism is SEN, and that's not something that I have a, like, a particular amount of experience in. So I do like to draw on her experience in those things. But then sometimes I do, like, she comes home with work, and I say to her, no, you're not doing that. Like, you're not doing work at home. You're not paid to do work at home. Don't be ridiculous. So I do kind of have to put my foot down as head of department at home and say, that's not happening.
Yeah. That must be a really funny role reversal in that sense. You know, in terms of the whole teaching thing.
I can't remember what it was she said to me once. She said to me, oh, as long as we still have parity in our conversations. And I didn't know what parity meant. And I text back and I said, what? So she went, okay, no, that's fine. I'm not worried. So I think it is. But at the same time, it's nice for us to be able to share those experiences with each other.
It's funny, though, because my children are very young, but one of them has a real aptitude for drama, the other one for dancing. Now, I was only thinking, what if one of them was to go in, you know, to do something to do, I don't know, broadcasting or lecturing or something, where I sort of, you know, have particular interests in it. And it's that sort of funny thing when you think, well, you want your children to do really well, but what if actually they're more successful than you are, you know, in particular areas? And I was thinking, how would I feel about that? Because part of me would probably be really jealous and like, but that's what I wanted to do. But then again, I'm really proud of them.
Yeah,
I'm sure that's natural. Yeah. But also particularly, I mean, my dad worked in the railways for 48 years.
Oh, gosh, wow.
And of course, not surprising, when I was really young, I wanted to be a train driver.
Oh,
you know?
Yeah.
But it's just funny. So in lots of ways, you know, obviously that's not the path I took, but you never quite know, and you've got to find your own feet.
Yeah.
And it sounds as though teaching is like something that really did inspire you.
Definitely. I've always wanted, I think there was a brief spell when I wanted to be an actress and kind of dabbled in a bit of drama and things like that, but yeah, teaching has always been something. I used to line up my Barbies and pretend to teach them with like little whiteboards and stuff. So so it's definitely always been something that I wanted to do.
And so when you're actually teaching real pupils rather than Barbie dolls, do you find that the experience of that matches what you originally always hoped it would be?
Yeah, I definitely think it does. Like, there's nothing about it that has not met my expectations. Like, it is everything I always wanted it to be. And in a way, a very strange way, I always say to people, you know, like, in a way, teaching is acting, because it's almost like no matter what's going on in your life, day, anything, you walk into that classroom and you are just the classroom teacher, and they need you. So maybe I have kind of combined the two potential career paths.
That notion of performance, I think, is really important, because I find that sometimes, that no matter how busy you are or what's occupying your mind, and sometimes you know you might get an email 2 minutes before you're about to go to class, which completely wrong-foots you. But then once you're in the classroom, you have to put all that to the back of your mind. And I always find that, although sometimes you think, oh gosh, I've got 2 hours of teaching, but, you know, there's just so much going on, you know, I'm not ready to do it. Once it actually begins, it's always, without doubt, the best 2 hours of my day.
Yeah, no, I agree. And like you say, no matter what's going on outside as well, like, you might have had an awful night, you might have had an awful morning, but when, like I say, when you're in that classroom, that's all that really matters, and there's all these little faces looking up at you, and particularly at the Langton girls, like, they want to know so much that you can't, like you say, that goes away. And it, like you say, it's like freedom almost.
But also the skills that you didn't know that you had. I mean, I find that, obviously, you were a student of mine once, but you do find sometimes when you're, say, giving presentations in classes, that there are certain dynamics or certain things that you have to do that once you've done them, you think, well, actually, that's going to be great for a job interview, or that's going to be great in a teaching context. But often skills that you didn't know that you had, but sometimes unexpectedly manifest themselves, and you get credit for it, and you put it on your CV, and you just think, wow, just sort of, you know, add it to the list.
Yeah, I found that with my questioning. Like, I didn't really ever think that I was particularly good at questioning, and then in my kind of early days of teaching, you know, like you say, I was praised for my questioning, and it is just something, I don't particularly plan my questions into my lessons, but it just comes out, and, like, you know, the students will ask a question and I'll, you know, ask them to dig a bit deeper, and, like you say, I kind of reflect on that afterwards and think, well, that was actually really good. I look forward to doing that again.
Yeah. And do you find, though, that no 2 days are ever the same?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, certainly I find it here with seminar groups, that teaching two different classes of students, or maybe it's the same module, but you're teaching, the classes are split into two, and I find that the dynamics are so different. And I sometimes find that I learned something in the first seminar group that I can impart to the second, but the dynamics are so different sometimes. I just sort of feel, well, I don't think I've done anything differently, but there's something about the classroom setup that, you know, makes me go away and reflect and see how I can change that for next time. But do you have that sort of experience?
I had it today, actually. I have 2 year 7 classes that I teach period 2 and period 6, and it was exactly the same lesson on the differences between gospel accounts of Jesus's life and the various stories and things like that. And the first class, period 2, absolutely flew with it. It was brilliant, and there was only questions like asking for further information. They understood the tasks, and it was wonderful. And then when I had taught the same lesson again, period 6, I went into it with exactly the same attitude, and they didn't understand some of the tasks in the same way, and so I was taken aback for, that momentary, like, oh gosh, like, okay. And so you do have to, like, think on your feet. And, you know, I didn't have time to, you know, kind of prepare a different lesson or anything. So I just had to go with it and, like I say, kind of adapt as I went. But yeah, like, exactly the same lesson, exactly the same year group, and two completely different kind of approaches to the topic.
Yeah. So you've got a whole lifetime now to unravel that, and you'll find it's often said, like, people like, you know, chancellors of the Exchequer, one day their aim is to deliver the perfect budget. But you know, one day there'll be a class, you think, do you know what, that couldn't have been improved on. But it may take you like decades to sort of say, wow, it's sort of finally we got there. You don't want to have, you don't want it to happen too soon, of course. Otherwise it's like,
from that point,
like, no. I've done my perfect lecture, there is no other ambition. Hopefully that won't happen now. But going in the opposite direction, what about very early memories? How far are you able to go back? What can you remember from childhood?
Oh gosh, I think some of my earliest memories are of just, I know it sounds silly, but houses in Whitstable. Like, we've lived in quite a few houses, we've moved around Whitstable quite a lot. So I think some of my earliest memories are of houses and playing in the garden. Like, not particularly exciting, but yeah, and maybe some holidays. I think we went to Cornwall. We used to go to Newquay, and so yeah, I remember had this little toy that you used to pop open, and the pigs used to move around inside. And I remember that from visiting a farm in Newquay.
Because I always used to farm, because I always kept a diary. But when I was really young, I wanted to always keep the diary to record the holidays rather than the normal routine. So I would talk about half term, and inevitably this was sort of like in the 80s, and I'd be writing about what I'd watched on TV, because I was home from school. But I was thinking, but that's crazy, because it'd be far more interesting to say, you know, these are the lessons I had, and this is what I learned, and this is what I was taught. So it's interesting that's that notion of holiday sometimes. We sort of bracket out, but the holidays only make sense in terms of the wider context of what you're doing. That's so different from the holiday. You know, the holiday make it feel so different that it feels very special. Although, I don't know how you felt, certainly holidays I went on, there was a point when you thought, do you know what, I think it's, you're ready to go back. You sort of feel that you've had that break from the routine, but it's also important to sort of almost like it reinforces the sense of, you know, you can't be on holiday forever like Shirley Valentine.
I find that with the summer holidays, and, you know, and you're probably the same, like, you do have to work. Like, it isn't a case of, oh, I'm going to sit back for 6 weeks. I mean, how lovely would that be? But I know it's not really the case. But even so, even popping into school and, you know, doing some work here and there, it's not the same as that structure. And so I do feel like by the end of the 6 weeks holiday in the summer, I think I'm ready to go back to work. It is that little, it's not, I'm not going to say it's too long, because you do have quite a lot to do, and it is nice to have a break. It is nice to get away. But I'm always ready to go back in September. Like, it is nice to get back into that routine.
I find sometimes when you've been on holiday for a couple of weeks or even 6 weeks, and you can have the odd lie-in or whatever, sometimes it's harder to get back into routine, because your body's saying, well, actually, it's too early to get up. But you know, sometimes I always feel better in myself when I am up. But so actually a break from the routine actually takes me a lot longer to, you know, adjust to than I feel it should. But the other thing is, I remember when the lottery was introduced in the 90s, and everyone thought, oh, you never have to work again if you win that £1 million and, you know, have a life of luxury. But to be honest with you, I think I can't think of anything worse. Because the thought of just sort of like thinking, oh, well, I'll just sit on a yacht. And what? And read magazines? Or something. It's like, no. So it's funny, isn't it? That sort of expectation of what is special, what is a break from the routine, and what the routine is, and how we navigate that and ensure that we kind of don't lose our sense of perspective.
Yeah, and I think the thing with the lions, you know, you think like a lion's nice after a busy week, but after 6 weeks of them, you're kind of like, well, it's not really. And your body starts maybe getting up at a regular time again anyway. Like, say, if you won the lottery and didn't have to work again, it would lose. You'd be like, Oh, okay. Yeah. I would lose that's what's special about it.
Of course, if I won the lottery,
I'm
happy to revise. I'm not saying I don't want to. I do play it, but we'll see. Maybe that's just my, you know, I'm just acclimatising the fact that I haven't won yet. You know, because if I win, you'll see me on the front page of one of the tabloids, and I, this life of luxury, never have to mark an essay again. Joy. Yeah. What about things that you enjoyed doing as a child, particularly? Were there any sort of like things to do with like film or dance or any sort of particular hobbies that you had in or outside of school?
So I like I said, I mentioned earlier, I loved drama, and I was in a couple of drama clubs. I was at the Horsebridge in Whitstable. They had a drama club, and I was in a drama club. And I also played a background orphan in Annie at the Marlowe Theatre when I was about 11, and I absolutely loved it. And I think I'd always kind of liked the whole drama thing before then, and then being on the stage at the Marlowe was just so overwhelming that I kind of thought, yeah, this is really, really what I want to do. And then unfortunately I got into the whole secondary school thinking I was far too cool to do things like that, and so stopped. And then that makes me a bit sad. I wish it was something that I had like pursued. But yeah, other than that, I think I still love trampolining. I was in a trampolining group, and swimming. I love swimming. I've still got my big towel full of sewn on badges from swimming. Like, you know, when you get your so many meters, you know, I used to love
I remember
like
that. I think I had one to say I did something like 50 yards. I don't think it's very much, is it? But I was really young, just to make it. I was 18, you know. But yeah, it was like my first swim, you know. I probably had armbands on, but at least it gave me the incentive to want to try harder next time. Maybe the 30 yards.
Yeah. No, they had like the little Frosty's tiger on it or whatever it was. But yeah, so I loved anything like that.
Yeah, no, sport was something I should have done, and I think I kind of regret it really, because too much of my time was probably spent doing lots of, you know, listening to radio and lots of indoor things, great, but I kind of feel that I miss the interactivity. But in later years, I think you find alternative ways of doing that, you know. I love being around people, but I'm conscious that sometimes when I was very young I didn't really throw myself into some of those activities, and I think I might be quite good at them, so I'm always quite active, but you know, I didn't channel it the right way. Games at school was my world. I hated it.
I did like it. I'd hated being outside. I hate getting cold. I can't cope with being cold, and most of it was, you know, they chuck you outside in your shorts with the hockey stick and tell you to get on with it, but so I hated that. But
what about music? Can you remember particular musical influences? Can you remember what was in the charts? Can you remember anything, either or not necessarily when you were born, but in the years afterwards? Were there any particular songs or particular artists that you remember listening to and identifying with?
I can't necessarily say anything from my earliest years, but later memory, when I went to Australia and I was about 10, and I'll never forget the CD that used to play in the car when we drive around, and it was just a mix CD of like cover songs, and so I don't have any specifics, but sometimes, you know, I'll hear the song on an advert or something, like another version, and it will take me right back to driving around Adelaide in the back of my uncle's car when I was 10. And yeah, so just those kinds of it was quite upbeat.
Yeah, I find that with particular tunes that I say recorded off the radio when I was at university, and it utterly takes me back to that day. And it's like I had an exam on that afternoon, or I met a certain friend and we went to play pool in the evening or something. But it's just very odd how that particular sound, even though I might hear that record many times over, but just listening to it on say a particular tape that I recorded, it's almost like the instantaneous transportation back to the point of origin. And so that song, which, you know, becomes a part of my autobiography.
Yeah.
And it sounds like you've got that experience. You've got this association then with a holiday in Australia.
Yeah, and that kind of like, and it creates that, it's not even just a memory, it's like a genuine feeling. Like when I hear the song, or when I'm playing the words in my head now, and it's like a genuine like wish to go back. A genuine wish I was either back in that moment or go and experience it again.
And do you feel, though, if you did go back, it would be very different? Is it sort of nice to go back in your memory and your thoughts, but you feel if you did go back, it would be a bit disappointing because you've got this, you build it up, and I find that you utterly build up. I mean, a lot of our memories are composite anyway, but you go back and think, actually, it's a little bit different to how it was, and the people are different. They're either older or maybe they're not around anymore.
Yeah. I think that if I went back, it'd be a very different experience, you know, 14 years later. But I have a lot more family there now, so I think it would be quite nice for me to go back. But just, I think I'd have to go back and manage my expectations. You know, it would have to be a new experience rather than a replication of the old
Yeah, it took me many years to have the confidence to go back to my old university because I was aware that having been there for so many years, I did, you know, more than one degree there. I kind of felt that if I went back, I couldn't quite anticipate how I would respond to seeing a place that either would look very different and I feel a bit sort of alienated from that experience, or it would look just the same, but the people weren't there that I associate with it. So that sort of intersection of people and places, I think, you is indissoluble. You can't separate one from the other. The memories that you have of holidays are going to be with the people who were with you at a particular time.
I feel the same about my school. I would have loved to have gone back to the Chaucer, but it closed down 2 years after I left, so we never got the chance. My friends and I often say, oh, wouldn't it have been great to go back? Wouldn't it have been great to go, you know, walk the halls again? And although the building's still there, it's not, you know, it's not running, and, you know, it's not functioning. So that would have been great to go back. But as the staff started dropping off kind of one by one, you know, it was like, actually, you're right, probably wouldn't have been the same to go back anyway. It probably would have been quite disappointing to go back, but you have that chance.
And tell me about university. I know it's not that many years ago, but in terms of particular experiences, particular classes or teachers or friends that inspired you, what are the sort of abiding memories of being at university in terms of the subject as well that you studied?
So I think the two big things for me with starting university was the fact that I stayed at home. I didn't move away. So I look back on that now, and sometimes my year 13s or my year 12s will say to me, oh, miss, do you recommend staying at home? You know, what were the benefits? Oh, I don't know what to do, money, blah, blah, blah. And I say, I do feel like I missed out to some extent. I do feel like I missed out on some of those experiences. You know, I don't feel like I had that university experience. But at the same time, I did other things as well, and I worked and I still enjoyed my studies and I still made friends. I just didn't have the whole living away in halls thing. So I don't know whether I regret that. I've kind of regretted it in the immediate years after, but now I'm kind of over it. I guess I'm over it, and I look back with fondness of university and not regret that I moved away. Now I'm in a reasonably good position now, stayed in the local area, I've done all right. So so it's like, it's not too bad.
No, I feel really privileged because I was able to go to a campus university and stay there. And it's so different. So your experience is actually not that different to, I'd say, the vast majority of students who often for work purposes, because we had student grants, you know, going way back to in the early 90s. And we didn't have to work. So it's a different sort of experience. But what is the advice that you would give your pupils?
Oh, it's difficult. I think I would think about what you want out of the degree, because if you're looking at maybe going straight into work, like I knew I wanted to go straight into work and I knew I wanted to work in the local area. So for me, it made sense as well. It made sense for me to go to university here, to do my teacher training here, to get a job in a school here. And for me, that's absolutely fine. But if not, if that's not your long-term plan, or you don't know what your long-term plan is, then potentially I would say move away. Particularly some of my students are really keen to follow fashion and things like that. And I would say, go to London, go and explore what it's like to live in London. Like one of my close friends, she moved away to live in London for 3 years and she absolutely thrived there. And she came back like a different person with so much confidence. And we all say that's absolutely because she moved and lived in London for 3 years. She wouldn't, I don't know if she would have had that transformation as much as if she'd stayed at university here. So I just think it postgraduate, like after you've graduated, what are your plans?
No, and I'm a big believer now in chasing indeed your dreams. Because they will come back inevitably if you have an ambition. I mean, in your case, obviously you're thriving at teaching, but it doesn't mean to say that drama, you know, who knows, in 20 years' time, you might sort of think, well, actually, I wouldn't mind dabbling in that. And I've got colleagues here, but I've interviewed one of them who's very senior in this university, who's a pantomime dame.
Amazing.
And it's, I don't know if that was something he wanted to do when he was younger, but it's so different to his day-to-day job. And it probably sort of sets his day-to-day job in a wonderful kind of relief, because it's like having lots of different things to look forward to and literally wearing different costumes.
Literally being somebody else. No, I agree. In terms of the subjects, like you said, I think I was a bit shocked when I started a philosophy degree, because my only real experience with philosophy was my A-level philosophy of religion, which is very, very different to kind of broader what actually, you know, kind of philosophy encompasses. So I think I sat in my first logic lecture and went home and cried. I sobbed because I had no idea what this guy was talking about. And I was panicked because we had an assessment and it was P's and Q's and symbols and all these words that I've never come across before, and I was stressing. And again, like we were saying like earlier, you know, I kind of really threw myself into it, and actually it turned out to be one of my best, and now I adore teaching it. I love teaching logic as part of my A-level, like as part of the, like I try and include it in, like to incorporate it as much as I can.
Because there is that argument, isn't there, that just because you enjoyed something, say at school, you shouldn't necessarily then just like do it again because it's easy and because it's safe. I remember doing as part of my RE, A-level John's Gospel.
Oh, yeah.
And I studied John's Gospel at university, and it was different in many ways. But also there was a part of me that thought it felt like the default position. But it also meant that I was often trying to think back, so what was I taught? And do I have my old notes with me? And I, in a way, I don't think that was handy. It was almost as though I was still holding on to something for a different form of assessment, a different level or stage of my life. And I probably should have just tried to almost like start from scratch.
No, I agree, because I loved sociology A-level. I did my sociology A-level. I did really well in it. I absolutely loved it. I adored my teacher. It was something that came really naturally to me. I didn't have to work at it as hard as I did my English literature or my philosophy A-level. So I started at university. I started a philosophy joint honours with sociology. And it was the same. I sat in my sociology lecture and I absolutely hated it. It wasn't what I thought it was going to be, or it was too similar to what it was before. And you know, you have that deadline of changing your degree option. And I changed it. I changed it to religious studies. I thought I have to try something new. I can't hold on to that. Oh, I'm good at sociology. I have to kind of break away from that and really try and explore something new.
So were you joint honours or single honours?
I was single honours. Single honours philosophy with, I did religious studies, like while, you know, the wild
modules. Oh, wild modules, that's how I knew you. Yeah.
Absolutely, I took Death of God with you.
Yeah,
I think that was... Death of God, I remember sitting the exam.
Yeah, and that module had a lot of philosophy students on it. So, absolutely, yeah. So, a lot of students I know took that module because they were interested in Nietzsche and they were interested in questions that arose in a philosophy context, but also helped me as a teacher because they were sometimes coming at it from a different angle. And I find that with my film module as well, the religion and film course. I've got students maybe doing film studies and they bring a different sort of lens.
Yeah.
And so it's the best form of teaching is when, to an extent, you're being taught by the students because they've got things to offer. And rather than say, I'm the expert, I'll tell you what's what, you think, thank you for that. And then I've often gone back and reframe and revisit some of my own thinking in the light of those conversations. So in a funny way, although volumes of marking can be horrible because they take up so much time and you've got to sort of find the time to do them, sometimes I find that there are things being written on my student papers and I think, gosh, you know, that's really almost like brought a different interdisciplinary lens, which also then impacts on my research in that area. So teaching is a very dynamic process.
Definitely.
Yeah. Tell me about other things at university. What about things like sport? I know you said trampolining was something that was really big when you were younger. Not sport, not really your thing.
No, yeah. I do it to keep fit. You know, I do it what's necessary. But since I left school and things like that, I've never engaged with it in a competitive. I'm not particularly competitive in that sense, so I've never been part of a sports club. I did the odd bit of athletics competitions when I was at school, but kind of past year 10, I didn't engage in anything.
What about film? Did that have any sort of influence on you at all? Cinema, has that played any sort of role in your life? Are there any sort of like go-to films?
Oh, I can't think of
that. Or interesting, the experience of cinema. Is going to the cinema something that you would do?
Oh, I love going. Absolutely adore going. Yeah. I adore going to
the cinema. So it's the ritual of going. That's interesting, rather than a particular film.
I think there are some things that I would say, you know, I look at a film and I say, oh, that'll be one to see in the cinema.
Yeah.
Maybe because it's going to have particularly good like visual effects or sound, you know, sound or something. I don't particularly like 3D. It makes my eyes hurt. It hurts my eyes to watch it in 3D. I feel like I can't focus properly. So I'll tend to maybe avoid unless it's absolutely essential or unavoidable. There are some films I look at and say, I'll wait for that to come out on Netflix or I'll wait for that to come out on DVD or something like that. But certainly, you know, that the all the Lords of the Rings film, the Hobbits films, the Harry Potters, the new Fantastic Beasts, all of those have been cinema kind of must-sees.
Now, 3D is interesting that you mentioned that because I had the same experience. I was watching one of the Saw films. It was in 3D. But I was sitting there, and because there was nothing about plot or narrative, it was about the effects, and it was pretty ropey effects. I don't know whether they added the 3D in afterwards, but it didn't feel particularly well put together. And I remember actually sitting there thinking, do you know what? I've got a batch of probably marking or something. And I just thought, kind of what that would be a better use of my time. And that's not good for someone who, you know, I'm a cinephile. And I found now, for many years, I didn't go to the cinema for all sorts of reasons. But I now go back quite a lot, as you probably know on Facebook, a lot. But I saw the Stan and Ollie film, the Laurel and Hardy film recently. And that was so wonderful. It was very, you know, it's a brand new film, but it's obviously a throwback to, well, the period from the 40s and mainly the 50s when they were a double act. And I just thought that it kind of conjured up a particular time and place and an age. And it was very carefully and there was real craftsmanship on offer. And I remember thinking a decade ago, I'd not sure I'd enjoy going to the cinema because it's all about putting on those 3D glasses and it's all about, you know, being scared because some hammer or some hook or some you know, scary demon or something is going to appear on, you know, right in front of you. And after the first 10 minutes, I kind of lost interest in that. But actually, I've recovered a fascination for cinema.
Yeah. One thing I did see at the cinema recently, which was awful, was my absolute favourite Christmas film, The Muppet Christmas Carol. All-time favourite. Now, I've realised when I've spoken to people about it, it's a bit of a divider. Some people absolutely adore it. Some people are like, can't stand the Muppets, don't want anything to do with it. But we went in London to see the sing-along version, which I thought was going to be absolutely fantastic, you know, my friends and I just before Christmas. And it was awful. I hated every moment of it to the point where we were so close to walking out because it wasn't just the sing-along, but it was almost like people were treating it as a live production, and people were saying the words, and every time Scrooge came on the screen, they were booing at him, and every time Rizzo came on the screen, they were clapping, and we were sitting there, we're like, I can't hear the words, like, I can't hear what's being said, and to me, it completely ruined my cinema experience. So I will never go to anything interactive in the cinema ever again. It ruined my cinema experience.
Yeah. Was if you were at home, would you have sung along, do you think, on your own?
Yeah,
But it was just because other people were almost taking that. Because I saw Mamma Mia, not the sing-along, but it was Mamma Mia 2, the weekend that it came out. And there were some people sing-along, and they were clearly a bit drunk. And at the end of it, somebody actually told them off and said, well, you know, thank you for ruining the film for me. And then they swore at him. So the film had sort of, on the one hand, it was nice that people were really engaging in it. And it was making them sort of feel very comfortable and at ease. But other people were probably thinking, well, you know, great, but I want to watch the film.
Yeah.
And you've now given me a different slant on that film, whereby I'm not hearing Meryl Streep singing, hearing your attempt to do, you know, Take a Chance on Me or whatever it might be.
See, the sing-along bits were lovely, you know, where everyone, the words came up on the screen, everyone was singing, everyone was doing what they're supposed to be doing. But like I say, this constant booing when Scrooge came on the screen, and you know, they'd be saying things and all you can hear is this audience booing. Sitting there thinking, this is ridiculous. I just want to go. I'll watch it on DVD.
That's interesting because in a pantomime, it's different because it's live. And if the people are really throwing themselves and booing, of course, they'll milk that.
Of course.
And it will affect their act. But if you're watching a film, then of course the film is going to proceed irrespective of what people are doing. I had one experience at university when The Jungle Book was shown and then the sound in the last 10 minutes disappeared and some people walked out thinking, well, you know, I'm not going to watch a film now where the sound has been lost. But those who remained, which most people, decided to provide their own commentary.
Amazing.
And it was the highlight. And it actually made me, it's like, you know, when Robin Williams did Aladdin, and he was so charismatic, you felt that there's no way he could have been reading a script. He was just improvising. And that's what made the film so special. He was sort of like almost doing a live theatrical interpretation. And when I saw The Jungle Book, so my memory of The Jungle Book, which I that might even be the only time I've seen it, but my sense is that it was a very interactive experience in those last 10 minutes. But that was almost by accident.
That's nice. That's lovely. It was so spontaneous.
Yeah,
I think my other big cinema moment, probably that's all coming back to me, was Les Mis, when Les Mis came out. And actually I came to watch it at the Gulbenkian three times. I came with my mum, and then I took my stepmum, and then my friend's mum wanted to go, but my friend didn't want to go, so I said, oh, I'll go with you. So my friend and I took my other friend's mum, and I cried more and more every time. And I think looking back, that's probably my favourite cinema experience is Les Mis. Absolutely adore that film.
I've got some films that I've seen certainly three times at the cinema. I don't know if I've been more than that, but certainly there are films that I have on multiple formats. Groundhog Day was one of those.
Oh, yeah.
And I had to show it to different friends.
Oh, yeah.
And it's more like, I think you'll like this one. And then inevitably you then buy on, as it used to be, VHS, and then on DVD, and there was like a special edition, and then the Blu-ray. And it's very interesting, almost as though I need to carry a particular product along with me, because it's in some way defined, or it has such an impact on me, it kind of you know, carries with me. And it's often an example I give in my teaching as well. So that sort of intersection between sort of film or popular culture and in a teaching context, I think is really important. Do you get that chance with your pupils sometimes? Do you find that talking about TV programmes or films is something that gets their attention? Is it something that you use in your teaching?
Definitely. I really try to. And there's been lots of times where I've referenced a film. For example, in my year 10 classes, we've been doing war. We've been looking at, you know, like War and Peace and things like that. And I referenced Hacksaw Ridge because we were talking about conscientious objectors and pacifism. And I said, you know, it's like in that film Hacksaw Ridge. And I just have this sea of blank faces. Mm. It's so infuriating, and it happens a lot. I say, oh, like that film, such and such, or like that thing, like that program. And I love to be able to, you know, pinpoint it to other things, and things just come to me and I say, oh, it's like this. And I really want to go to town on showing how that like demonstrates it. But yeah, no, nobody had seen Hacksaw Ridge and there was, I can't remember, I think I tried to talk about Dunkirk as well, and then nobody had seen that, and the Darkest Hour. I tried to talk about that, and because we're doing just war theory, and you know, looking at the Darkest Hour, and you know how kind of the process that had to be gone through to make those decisions, and yeah, nobody had seen it of it, and so I find that quite difficult, and I don't know whether that's I want to say a generational thing. They're 15. I don't know if that's a whole different generation to me. I don't know how generations work.
Well, I found it, well, in a university sense, because a generation is just 3 years, in the sense that students spend 3 years and then another set will come. And obviously there's an overlap in between. But I found that, because I teach the same modules that I, you know, was doing 15 years ago. However, and obviously it's not like the same script.
Yeah.
However, sometimes I might use the same examples each year, but whereas maybe 10, 15 years ago, half the students would have seen a film I mention, by the end, there might just be one or two, or a lot of them would just say, never even heard of it.
Yeah.
So that is an onus on me to think about how I can communicate,
and that,
which is one of the reasons I go to the cinema a lot. But it worked in my religion film module. We were looking at Christ films or representations of Jesus, and I said, who's seen The Greatest Story Ever Told? No one. Who has seen The Last Temptation of Christ? No one. I think some have seen The Passion of the Christ, but generally for a comparative purposes no one could do anything. And then I thought, I've got 2 hours of this, this is not off to a good start.
Going well.
But then I said, who has seen Bohemian Rhapsody?
Oh.
And suddenly the look, they were like, our lecturer is talking about films that we saw last night with our friends. And suddenly, rather than like films that are on the curriculum, suddenly it was like, we know that. And I had them. Then on the top of my head, I was thinking about this whole, you know, drawing, you know, various parallels with the sort of way that you go back over somebody's life and some, you know, highlight particular areas, or there might be a particular death narrative in that case. And of course, then the impact in Freddie Mercury's case on his, you know, what happened in the, 27, 28 years after he died. But suddenly, for me, I was realizing that although I'd come prepared with a particular set of notes, I could have just read those out, but it was quite obvious that I would have lost the audience. But just one example, and suddenly that became the reference point.
Nice.
So that's really satisfying. And so although that film Hacksaw Ridge may not have worked in that context, don't give it up.
No, I won't. Oh, no, I'll keep. And maybe the answer is to show clips. I mean, you know, like kind of, if they haven't seen it, well, expose them to it, you know, introduce them to it.
Yeah.
Obviously, vet them first.
Oh, I did that once. And I shouldn't be admitting this, but I remember once I had a school of sixth form in, and some of them were 18, but I checked with the teacher first. I said, well, I've got a clip from Pulp Fiction. And I said, is that okay? And she said, they've all seen it.
Oh, no.
Not from her, but just, you know, they see it anyway. So I thought, okay. But, and you mentioned A Muppet Christmas Carol. We had, in, I think it was 2014, here in SECL, we had a poll, and we asked staff and students to vote for their favourite Christmas film, and that was number one.
That's amazing! Oh, see, I knew there were people like me out there somewhere.
No, and I think that was the runaway favourite, actually.
Amazing. It's the best.
Although there was a bit of an argument afterwards, because Die Hard was somewhere in the, I think it was in the top three.
Yeah.
And but some people said, it's not a Christmas film. And that, you know, there's proper articles on this, you know. So
I was going to say, that's not a new argument. Yeah. I've heard that argument.
Yeah. And then just before Christmas, a friend emailed said, I won't watch a Christmas film. You're the expert. Is Lethal Weapon a Christmas film? And I just thought, oh, dear.
Wow, you're the authority on what is and isn't a Christmas film.
And I thought, well, you know, it's nice, but really. I'm not a one-trick pony.
Oh,
but
brilliant.
What about things like politics? Obviously, religion has been covered, but I found for me, when we had the 2017 election, I couldn't believe, obviously you'd graduated by then, but I couldn't believe what was going on campus. Everybody was like standing outside. I didn't even know there was a polling station on campus and people were voting. And my recollection of being of teaching, even like the 2010 election, is that I didn't get the sense that students were quite as involved in the process as back then. But what was your sense in terms of things going on politically? What was going on in the news? How big an impact has that played? Or did it play when, for example, you were a student?
I don't feel that it's particularly had an impact on me, but I would definitely say that I agree with you. And actually, I think that there has been that shift really recently of students actually wanting to be involved, and certainly students, you know, under 18, wanting that education and actually asking, why are we not taught more? Obviously, you can take politics A-level, but that's not quite the same as having a political education kind of embedded in the, you know, in the curriculum. You know, we try and cover, you cover British values, you cover religion, you cover all these things, and then at 18 you're kind of, they're supposed to be like spat out and know what to vote and how to make you know, how to make a difference. And so, you know, but I'm hearing this from students and saying, why don't we, you know, why can't we know stuff? And actually, people that I've spoken to that I've kind of challenged that are my age that don't vote, the response is always, oh well, I don't know about it, so I'm not going to to vote, I'm not going to waste a vote, or I'm not going to, you know, make an uninformed decision. No, I think that's really something that needs tackling.
Yeah, because I heard that some years ago, but I don't hear it now, and that's what I find really interesting. And I was really struck at my daughter's primary school when I heard some of the other parents, or maybe even some of the people, talking about Trump, and I thought that's interesting because some politicians would do anything to be heard, but of course, in a lot of cases, it was quite negative. But I was just thinking, people, you know, Ed Miliband or Nick Clegg, people wouldn't have been talking about them in the in the school playground. But now people are talking about, I don't know about primary school, but, you know, I'm sure your pupils are talking about Brexit.
Oh, absolutely. And when I was finishing off, when I was finishing off my PGC placements, I was in a primary school. My second placement was a primary school, and they had a Brexit day. They had a day where it was like a drop-down day where students came in, and I think it was just the year 5-6 class, but they came in and they did a whole day on Brexit. And they looked at the kind of, they were given information about the benefits, they were given information about the, like, you know, the negatives, what's good about being in, what's good about leaving, history, and then the students had to vote at the end, this whole day on it. And that was because the last day of my PGCE was the day I handed in my portfolio, was the day the Brexit vote was announced. So, yeah, it was an interesting day. Some highs, some lows. But yeah, so, but that was, but to me, yeah, so like 9 and 10 year olds having a whole day on Brexit. And I just think, like you say, I think, you know, the kind of emergence of Donald Trump and the Brexit thing has really kind of thrust politics into kind of popular popular culture or popular kind of knowledge and stuff, which is good in a way, but at the same time, obviously, you get left with a lot of misinformation.
Oh, absolutely, and all the fake news stuff. But that's interesting, because there was a time when I was at university and so many of my friends would say, they're all the same, doesn't matter who you vote for. People are not saying that anymore.
No, absolutely not. And I also think there's a breakaway from just voting for who your parents voted for as well. Like, people are actually, there are some students I feel, you know, they say something and the cynical part of me says, that's not from you. That's mum and dad sitting on the couch sofa at home watching the TV saying things. You know, and you think that is not your opinion. But I definitely think that we're moving away from, you know, just kind of voting for who your family has historically voted for. People are asking. People are curious. People are kind of looking for the answers themselves, or like putting those questions out there.
Yeah, and you must also find, as somebody who was studying religious studies modules and obviously teaching now, the whole question about what you're studying religion for. Is that something that you get? I get that all the time. People will equate that, you know, if you're studying something, you must have some career or personal faith perspective. And do you get that sort of questioning a lot?
So I have different questions. So at my previous school, I was asked all the time, why are we doing this, why does this matter, you know, etc. I don't have that anymore. You know, the girls at the Langton are absolutely incredible, and they don't ask those kinds of questions. They ask different questions. But you're right, I often get asked, so are you religious, miss, or, you know, what kind of affiliation do you have with the church or something? And like you say, it's this kind of assumption that because you are a religious studies teacher, but you don't get that in another subject. I don't feel you get that in another subject. That's my personal experience. Or that through trying to teach religion, you are trying to teach to be religious, which is very different. To approach religion from a kind of, you know, that critical analysis, that academics point of view, is very different from, you know, I'm not training them up to be good little Christians or Muslims or anything like that. But I definitely feel, you know, I often try and use the kind of example of, oh, do you study World War II? And they say, oh, yes. And I say, well, you're not a World War II pilot, are you? And they say, oh, no. Or, you know, I say, do you study Shakespeare? Yes, well, you're not Shakespeare, are you? You know, so I say, so just because you're studying religion doesn't make you religious. And they kind of go, Oh, yeah, okay. Like I said, I don't have that as much.
No, they're really good analogies. You know, all the one, you don't have to be French to study French.
Yes.
However, I had this in McDonald's with my children just this last weekend. And I was asked, so what do you teach? Or, you know, I said, I work at the university. And then suddenly a whole set of questions. It turned out the chap I was speaking to was a pastor. But he didn't reveal that at first. But I gave away what I did, and he was really trying to get a sense of, well, what do you believe then? And I thought it was the context that was incongruous, because I deal with these questions all the time. Yeah. And I thought, I can bat these easily. You know, it's pretty straightforward. I couldn't be doing the job I did without being able to have an answer here. But I think it was because I was outside of my comfort zone, and I didn't quite know where the conversation was going. And also that sense of giving an answer where the other person's going to be sort of really quite disappointed in the answer. Mm. And you're sort of thinking, well, I'm trying to do what I can just to steer away. We don't need to go down that path. No. It's not. So it's interesting how much or how little sometimes I want to give away about myself. Yeah. In those sort of contexts. But it never comes up. You're right. We never ask our students, and they never ask us. And it's almost for that reason. It's like the elephant in the room. You know, everywhere, it's there, but no one's talking about it.
Yeah, you know, yeah. It is. Well, the big one, I remember when I was at university, you know, meet people out at bars or something, and say, oh, you know, what are you studying? Where are you from? Where are you staying? You know, those kinds of things. And you'd say philosophy, and they'd go, what's that? Yeah. You know, what's philosophy? Yeah. And trying to give that to somebody in a basic answer in a bar, yeah. You know, yeah. What is philosophy? I mean, gosh, where do you even start, kind of thing? And the answer you give is always rubbish, and they look at you and say, well, that sounds really boring.
Yeah. Well, so being this is the real test. Being asked in McDonald's when you've got screaming children around you, what is the difference between theology and religious studies? Now, that for me, and I just thought, I know, I've given papers on this. I've answered that question many times over. But why isn't the answer? I should go around with a little script.
Yeah, but, let me just check.
Yeah, I know. I should know my own work. Yeah. But it also came up in a conversation I had with somebody at a wedding, literally about 2 or 3 weeks after I graduated back in 1994. Gosh. And I think one of my either parents or my grandfather said something like, oh, my son, you know, your grandson has just graduated from university and he did theology. And the chap said, so what's that then? And it's like, oh, I've just done this degree, I've written a dissertation for law's work, but I can't think of a single word. And he said to me, is it something to do with computers? And, you know, and I was so wrong-footed by this. And I also thought, and I probably came across as somebody very bumbling and very, you know, I was completely incoherent. But that again, is an interesting thing in life when we're outside of our comfort zone and we have to communicate. It's the same if you go back and meet your own teachers from school.
Yeah.
Certainly I had that. And suddenly you realise that you've got qualifications that they didn't have and you followed a different sort of path. And yet they last saw you. You last had a conversation with them at the age of like 16.
Yeah.
And suddenly now you're speaking adult to adult. Mm. And that takes a lot of adjusting.
I agree. And actually, funnily enough, that my English teacher at school was, he was wonderful. Mm. And he left in about year 13 to go and be the deputy head at the Langton Girls. Mm. And so when I got my interview and, you know, and I was like, oh gosh, I wonder if he's still there. And I tried to look on the staff list, but I couldn't really make it out. And then on my interview day, they had a list of who you're going to be interviewed by. One of my two panel interviews included his name. And I remember just thinking, how am I going to sit in front of this man and persuade him that I am an adult and persuade him that I am capable of being a head of department? You know, I had not, last time he saw me, I was a moody 17-year-old who was stropping with him because he was leaving halfway through our A-level, and I was thinking, how on earth am I going to persuade him that I'm good enough? And he was brilliant, and he's a lovely man anyway, so he made me feel very comfortable. But it took me a long time to get on first name terms with him. I kept calling him sir. Yeah. And he said, you need to stop calling me sir, you know, my name is what my name is, you need to call me around here. And it took a long time to kind of get out of that. But
yeah, no, that happens an awful lot, and it's really funny, isn't it? And you also find that even if you like go back to the street where you were born and you meet people who are now like, you know, 20, 30 years older than they were when you last saw them, and you almost like regress to being that 6-year-old again.
Yeah.
And it's almost like, because the last time you had a conversation with them, you were a little boy.
Yeah.
Maybe a naughty little boy. And like suddenly now you've got to almost like prove to them, yeah, well, actually, I'm very responsible.
Yeah.
And then, but then looking, so you're like, but now, why are you telling me about where you've been and what you've just studied and all the rest of it? And just funny. And I think it's in life, we build up relationships, but sometimes we have to, you know, and it's great character building, but sometimes you just have to know that, you know, certain conversational areas work
in some contexts, but not in others. And you learn the hard way when you then, I mean, I had it at university when some people would say things like, well, I went to the University of Life, you don't need to get a degree to be knowledgeable. Gosh. And really a sort of defensive attitude. It's very hard to know quite how to answer that, because you kind of know that there's a bridge here, that although there isn't, you know, you need to, there's a divide here, and it's kind of, you're not really going to meet anywhere in the middle. In terms of perhaps some more, appropriately in terms of your degree, but more philosophically based questions, would you say your memories, you know, in any memories in your life, are predominantly positive ones?
Positive memories. I always loved school. And I know that sounds, seems like I have a bit of an agenda here, but I have such positive memories of schools. I have such positive memories of teachers. I always loved going to school. I love the fact that I can remember things that I learned when I was at school, and even, you know, times when maybe I have fond memories of school for different reasons. I loved the social side of it. I also loved exams, which sounds bizarre, but I was such an exam person. I wasn't a coursework person. I was very much an exam person. So I love that pressure that exams give, you know, and that kind of like that feeling of that like pressure on top of you. I absolutely love that. But yeah, apart from that, I guess kind of earlier family memories. I guess some of my favourite memories are being off school ill. You know, like when you take a day off sick, like there's no feeling like that, and that's kind of gone now, hasn't it? Because even if you took a day off now, you're setting cover, and it's wake up at 6 a.m. still to set cover. It's not quite the same. But yeah, my mum used to make, when I was really young, she used to make these little donuts, these little dinky donuts. And I remember, yeah, if I was ill, she'd make those, or we'd go down the shop and buy, which they're kind of associated with bad food. But yeah, there's kind of that legitimate day off school when no one else is off school, you know, you haven't pulled a sickie, but that legitimate I'm actually really ill. And so yeah, I think some of my nicest memories are of being ill at home.
Because it raises that question as well, you know, whether you can be nostalgic about negative experiences. But I guess it's often that even with a negative experience, you can turn it and channel it into something positive, like being ill. But it's like, well, I can't do what I would normally do today, but I'm just gonna have a different outlet, or I'm gonna ensure that I'm able to achieve something now that I'm haven't got my regular routine that I otherwise wouldn't have the chance to do. So it can be strangely productive.
And like I say, I think it's just that and looking back on it, I think you, like I say, you'll never, I don't feel like I'll ever have that again. I don't feel like I'll ever have a day off when no one else is off with no responsibility, you know, that real kind of your mum's called in for you, you're off the hook, no one's coming after you, no one's going to question you, you're off, you're poorly, cuddle up on the sofa with your snacks, and you know whereas now, like I say, start feeling ill and I'm like, well, I can't take a day off because setting cover is more stressful than going into work. I can't bear the thought of setting cover. So I feel like those days are kind of well and truly gone.
No, I found that I don't think I've ever really missed a class, and for that reason you know that you're gonna have to rearrange it anyway, so you know it's gonna happen. So sometimes there is an argument, like, I just want to do it because it actually will make me feel worse, because on top of feeling ill, there's that sense of having to do something the following week when you've already got a full week, you know, and you're doubling up on yourself. But it is hard. But maybe also when you're a child, you don't think in the same sort of way. And it's nice to look back and you think sometimes, but it seems so easy then because you didn't have the responsibility. But I'm not sure I'd want to be an adult without responsibility.
No, absolutely. Yeah. Like we were saying earlier about the always having time off thing. Yeah. Like, yes, it seems like a great idea. But in reality, would I want to be an adult who never had to get up for work? Yeah. No. Unless I'd won the lottery.
Yeah. Well, and actually back with my next question, actually, you've already answered, but it was about whether you fulfilled the dreams you had when you were young. But I think you still might. It sounds like something in acting. You never know. But it doesn't have to be an alternative to what you're doing. But you can do it alongside. Yeah. Or maybe even doing some acting or some drama with your pupils.
Yeah, I think I would like that, actually. And I think that was an element of being in a primary school that I did like, but the rest of primary teaching wasn't for me. But yeah, I think that I definitely feel like I have fulfilled my dreams. I think that one day I would like to work in a university. I think maybe on like the teacher training course, you know, like working on the initial teacher training. But certainly I didn't think I'd be a head of department as in early in my career as I have. So I've actually kind of exceeded what I dreamed to have done, certainly early on. Kind of had like the by 30, you know, like by 30 I need to have done X, Y and Z. So to get it, to, you know, 24, I'm pretty pleased with that. But Yeah, so I guess just carry on.
No, because I know some colleagues who were made professor in their 30s. And sometimes I think that's great, but in a way you haven't got that same sort of sense of... I mean, you can still be ambitious, but there's almost a sense that you may... I'm not
a
general point, but yeah, either peak too soon or indeed where next?
I think because what I said to, you know, back at the beginning of the year, I was starting to get like itchy and I couldn't work out what it was. Mm. But I think it was because, you know, GCSEs and then 2 years of A-level and then 3 years of undergraduate and then a year of teacher training. There was always something you were like working towards. And like I said about like that feeling of pressure with exams, I absolutely loved that feeling. Like I kind of thrived on it. And so when I was like into my second year of teaching, although you are always working towards something and you can always be better at teaching, those are little goals you can work towards on a day-to-day basis or a term-by-term basis. But I was thinking, I need to be working towards something. I need to feel a bit of pressure, aside from just general teaching pressure. And so that's when I started looking around for like higher positions. I just thought, I need something. I dabbled with the idea of a master's. I thought, is that the way I want to go? And I still will probably at some point do a master's.
Absolutely, because I remember in my case, I did my GCSEs in 1989, A-levels 91, then first degree 94, did a master's 96, and then PhD 10 years after my GCSEs. And almost because that happened in that period, but the following 10 years were nothing like as productive in that same way. And it almost feels as though I'd achieved so many things by my like mid-ish 20s that in a funny way, you almost like feel a sense of displacement.
That's how I felt, Like I always felt like dissatisfied with what I had in life. That's really ridiculous and not a very good way to live, like always wanting more. But I feel like I'm always going to want more, which there will probably come a point when that's, I need to say, no, you just need to be happy with your lot for the moment. But
And do you have siblings?
I have an older brother, and he lives in Australia.
Oh, right, so that's the connection. But I was just wondering in terms of how that dynamic plays out in that context, because are you both similarly ambitious?
So we're very different. So I was I was academic, like I said, loved school, loved exams, he was very different. He was extremely bright and he was academic, but just school wasn't for him. I would just want to work, I want to do, and he's got a brilliant work ethic, you know, he worked so hard, but he wasn't an academic, sit down and do GCSEs and read books and stuff.
But it sounds like you've got that in common, though. The work ethic is clearly what is connecting
you. Yeah, we just went different
you.
Ways. But he went off to do tree surgery. So he trained as a tree surgeon. And then he moved to Australia 5 years ago and is absolutely thriving out there. So we've both achieved in our fields, but have gone very different ways about it. But
and,
I think,
and literally in his case.
Yeah, literally. But I think that I'm probably more, I think he's more satisfied. The only thing, he came back at Christmas and he said, oh, my knees hurt. He said, I feel old before my days, you know, because of the work that he's doing. But yeah, I think I'm definitely more kind of, I get like, you know, like the foot tapping starts and I need to be doing something else and I don't know what it is yet. So I don't know whether I need to find something that will properly satisfy me.
But there's also that wider matrix in terms of what other friends are doing and people that you grew up with. Because I'm assuming, I know you're in touch with friends from your past, or maybe I say your past, it's very relative in your case. But do you have that sense of comparison, different sort of markers in terms of different things, different career journeys that you're all on?
Yeah, it's nice because, like I say, I've got my four my best friends from school that we've all stayed in touch. And we have all gone down the career path, very, very different career paths. So I've got one friend who's in the police. I've got a friend who's a social worker, my friend who's a graphic designer, and then a friend who works at the hospital doing like blood testing and things like that. And so
I met her there in that very context once. I know exactly who you mean.
Of course. And you knew her from before anyway,
didn't you? She was in your class.
And she loved your religion and film. She raves about the religion and film module, absolutely. So it's nice that we have all stayed around and we have all kind of succeeded in the fields that we wanted to succeed in. So that is quite nice. Like, I don't feel like we're not in competition with each other, nobody's been left behind, you know, we're all in it together, we're all moving towards the same goals, you know, in terms of we're all career minded, which has been quite nice. None of us are particularly family marriage oriented at the moment. We're very much like,
very young.
Career. that's been nice for me. They're so encouraging, you know, they've been so encouraging me. We're really supportive of each other. because we're all able to, because we're not in competition with each other. Does that make sense?
That's really important, actually. And that I lost touch with various people, as one does, certainly in a pre-social media age, and also moving around the country a lot. And I've started to cultivate some of those friendships, but it took a while.
Yeah, I can imagine.
And that was a bit displacing. In some cases, you just pick up the conversations that you had 20-odd years ago.
Yeah.
But in other cases, of course, you find that people have followed very different paths, and you may never see them again.
That's sad.
But my very last question, are you a looking back or a looking forward kind of person?
Very much a looking forward. Very, very much looking forward. I don't particularly tend to look back unless I have to for whatever reason. I'm very much a, like I've said, like, what's next, you know? And I guess to some extent I can use what's gone, but I don't like to dwell. And I know that looking back can be positive. It doesn't always have to be negative, but I do see, like, looking back sometimes as quite positive. I wish I was more of an in the now person. I very much wish I was in the now. I'm not, and I wish I was. Maybe that would kind of help with some of the lack of satisfaction thing. But yeah, I think that I'm always going to be looking forward, like, what's next. I'm a big planner. Like, I think I heard a conversation I was in the car and I heard it on the radio. They were saying, oh, you know, you shouldn't have too much of a plan in life, because it was one of these chat show, like, late in the evening. And, you know, they were saying, oh, you know, you shouldn't have a plan because, you know, that'll bog you down. It'll put pressure on you that you don't need. And I just said, I was like, how can you not have a plan? Like, the thought of not even having at least like a 2 or 3 year plan is really stressful to me. So definitely a looking forward person.
Yeah. Abby, it has been so wonderful to catch up again. Thank you very much.
And you. Thank you so much.